to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Really, really fortunate to have four people to help us work through what really is one of the thorniest and in some ways most fascinating, but the definitely trickiest of the issues that face any massive digitization project, Orkinworks, four people that will help us with that all have devoted a huge amount of time to thinking about this. In the case of Jewel Siegel, as you just heard, a tremendous amount of time drafting an actual attempt to try to do something about the problem. So, start with Jewel. Jewel is a senior policy counsel for copyright and trademark at Microsoft, where he deals with precisely these issues and many more. As you heard in the exchange with Larry, he was at the Copyright Office in 2006 and was the primary drafter for the office's copyright report and proposed legislation. Also, this morning on my left, on the far end, is James Brimmelman, who is a law professor at New York Law School. James is probably one of the earliest and most thoughtful analysts and commentators on the Google book search deal. The piece he wrote right after the deal was announced is still one of the best and most insightful and incisive early reactions, and he's only continued to think more carefully and more critically. And the other good thing, James is also a geek in the very best way. He's a science major here at Harvard College under the tutelage of Harry Lewis, who's here with us. Actually worked as a programmer at Microsoft for a while before going on to his legal career. And just a plug for James, on the resources page of the website that we have up, you'll see a link to James's site, thepublicindex.org, which he has created, which is a tremendous set, a compendium of resources for the Google Book Search settlement. All of the documents from the court process, all of the documents from the approval process, huge amount of underlying documentation. So for anyone interested in the settlement or the issues, that's the go-to place. On my right, we have Eric Saltzman, who was the second executive director of the Berkman Center, one of the founders and a board member of Creative Commons, on the board of Science Commons as well. He's a lawyer, but also a filmmaker, and has thought a tremendous amount about these kind of public domain, public access issues, and of course, through his Creative Commons and Science Commons work. And at the far end, Lewis Hyde, who is a longtime Berkman fellow. Lewis is a poet and author of The Gift, among other works, has thought for many, many, many years about the commons and the role of public domain commons in society, and is currently working on a book about the cultural commons. So welcome, all of you. We're talking about Orkinworks, which I think you all know. Those are works that are still in copyright. They're out of print, but they're in copyright, so they're not public domain. But the problem is, it's virtually impossible to find who the owner of the copyright is. So if you want to use the work, if you want to scan the work as part of a digitization project, if you want to display it, distribute it, you can't find the person to ask who owns the rights to ask for permission, which means you face a very difficult conundrum. You can go ahead and use the work, and if the author shows up somewhere later and decides to sue for copyright infringement, you potentially are on the hook for a lot of money. That's the problem that people like Jewel and the Copyright Office and others have tried to deal with for quite a few years now. The Google Book settlement solves this problem for Google and Google only. We might touch a little bit along the way on how it does that and some of the specifics, but what we want to try to do more of is to talk about the problem more broadly and about other approaches to solving it under different branches of the decision tree that John Palfrey talked about this morning. If the settlement goes through, what does that mean for everybody else in Orkinworks? If the settlement doesn't go through, what do we do? What's left? How do we fix the problem? If the settlement is modified in some way, how could Orkinworks be better protected? So I think what we're going to do is start off with James. Just
So just in a preliminary note, my students who I worked with deserve most of the credit for setting up the public index. They really did a lot of the incredibly hard work in creating and hyperlinking all that we've got. So what I'm going to talk about today, I don't have any idea of how long this will run, is a different way of looking at the branch of the decision tree in which the settlement is approved, and thus possibly some reflections on whether the settlement should be approved. Some of us have complained that the settlement is a ticket good for Google only, that this is really a Google gets a deal that leaves a lot of other companies and a lot of other interests behind. But one of Google's consistent responses to this has been, anyone is free to do what we've done. And to this point, I've responded to this primarily by diving into the details of class actions, trying to argue that plaintiffs might not be willing to settle with others on the same terms that Google wants, or perhaps even more fundamentally, that the same terms aren't what people who are doing orphan works really want. They're concerned about some of the restrictions in the deal. But what if I'm wrong about this? We could turn the question inside out. What if we really could try to file a class action suit and then settle it on terms that create some form of meaningful open access? So I want to talk about the possibility that Google Book Search style class actions could be used as a device for producing something like an orphan work solution. So this is partly a not completely joking proposal. Somebody in this room could actually go out and try to file this lawsuit, and it might produce results. And it's also a way of thinking about what the settlement really means, what makes it distinctive. So I'm not sure whether what I'm going to do is extraordinarily cynical or extraordinarily naive, or perhaps both. But it's an exercise in generalization, the way that you would do in the first semester of law school. Asking, here's a settlement, it's very complex, which terms in it really are the essential core holding? So the first step in filing a class action orphan works lawsuit would be to identify the parameters of the lawsuit itself. We need to have the suit in order to have a settlement. So you start by identifying the class. You pick the works you're trying to make available, perhaps some subset of books, perhaps the set of books themselves that Google's been scanning, perhaps some other genre, photographs, or other media. And of course, you want to have orphans in that class to serve open access goals. You're looking for works that you can make available again. But you also need non-orphans in the class in order for some of them to be class representatives. You need to find someone to negotiate with. So the one distinctive feature of the lawsuit is that it spans both orphan and non-orphan works. You then need to have a justiciable case or controversy against the class so that the court really can hear the lawsuit. Query whether this lawsuit needs to be justiciable against the entire class or merely against enough of it that you can negotiate in good faith. The Supreme Court may weigh in on this very topic when they talk about registration in an offsuit from the Ticini case that's going up there. Then you need to have, at the very least, the real threat of litigation from some members of the class. It's partly avoiding collusion, so you need to do something that ticks off some members of the class enough that they really will at least threaten to sue you to the point that you can file a declaratory judgment, or ticks them off enough that they really do sue you and want to win. So you're walking a very interesting line here. You need to avoid having the lawsuit be collusive from start to finish, but you nonetheless have to get people who want to negotiate with you. So the actual Google Book Search lawsuit is fascinating in this way because they managed to tick off copyright owners enough to get them to file this gigantic lawsuit and be furious about it, but nonetheless they have something to offer these people that could result in a real deal. So this raises the question of what your initial behavior is. What do you do that triggers the copyright controversy? Google Book Search focused on digitization. The biggest orphan works problems deal with things that are not born digital, so you can create a copyright controversy by digitizing them. If you then, like Google, say, we are making internal use copies, we won't distribute these or sell these as such to the public, you've then set up a plausible fair use argument that might give you a good chance to win, but also the kind of thing that would make people who own copyrighted content understandably aggrieved at you. So archiving is one solution. I'm thinking here about something like abandonware in the context of software and older games, where you have people who are out there just archiving this stuff and making it available. And that's been a kind of de facto orphan works approach in that one space. Conversely, you could think about having some non-digital archives of material where you're making some preservation solution that's not online. Having gotten into the lawsuit, you then need to find these people and negotiate a deal with them. And what are the essential parameters of the Google Book Search lawsuit that make the court at least potentially willing to approve it? One thing that I think Google has really relied on is the existence of a strong opt-out option. Not only can anyone simply opt out of the deal and stay on the same terms they were before, they can also choose to pull their books from all of the display uses where Google actually sells content at any point. Having something like that baked into your deal, any owner who does show up and proves not to be an orphan can reassert control, diffuses a lot of plausible objections to the settlement, because people can argue, it's hard to argue that your rights have been deeply prejudiced when at any point you can show up and reassert them. It is a de facto switch between opt-out and opt-in in copyright law. Google Book Search draws that line at things that are in print. If it's not commercially available, they'll presume that you consent unless you object. So in picking your set of works to trigger a settlement over, ask whether there's some dividing line, like the in-print, out-of-print line in books, that you can point to and set that kind of presumption on. The second interesting thing here is the range of authorized uses. Google Book Search shows that the range of uses can be pretty broad and include the core rights to distribute and sell that we think of as the heart of commercial exploitation. You need to be specific, though, I think. You couldn't just effectively convert something into public domain. You need to create a fairly well-defined set of, we will do this, this, and this, but we're not taking the whole of the copyright for it. Compensation is the trickiest part of this. It may be impossible to do a deal treating Google as precedent unless there's money in it, which is not a great thing for open access causes. You need to have some money to prime the pump. The Google Book Search settlement works, though, because the owners of content like the deal enough that they're willing to settle. And because they like the deal on economic terms, they're plausibly good proxies for orphan owners. You need some mechanism to pay them, and you might want to think about the inclusion fees versus the ongoing royalties. Google was very careful to structure their deal such that they're not paying fees for licenses, only to settle the lawsuits of people whose works they've already scanned. That is, here's a copyright claim, we'll compromise it, but we're not buying a license with your $60. The only licensing fees Google is paying are the ongoing revenues based upon use. So if you want to do real open access, you might want to structure the deal such that you don't pay up front, you don't digitize very many works, but then you start paying proportionate to the uses that are being made in some way that improves public access. The hardest part, ironically, may be finding the money to pay the attorneys of the copyright owners who negotiated with you. That's the biggest single upfront expense that I can see in the Google Book Search deal that a future deal like this would have to rely on. There are also a few other ancillary matters to think about as you go through this. The Google Book Search deal includes some pretty rigorous security standards. Ask whether you can get the copyright owners on board without that. It includes some provisions in the author-publisher procedures to actually restructure rights that are out there in the industry. So perhaps as part of your settlement, you can actually get the copyright owners to compromise with each other and simplify the structure of rights that create part of that documentary film problem. It also includes a dispute resolution mechanism, another technique that both mitigates some risk and can be used to simplify matters on the ground. People keep on having ideas for things like fair use or orphan works adjudications, where you can get a specified approval for this particular use. Perhaps you could borrow some arbitration proceedings to simplify that and make it less expensive. The notice program you'll have to do as part of the lawsuit may be big and potentially expensive, and their hard upfront cost may be very hard to dodge. And then think also about piggybacking public benefiting ancillary uses onto a revenue-producing core use, thus perhaps an archive that sells things for commercial purposes, but offers some non-commercial online browsable version for free to the world. And so one last radical closing thought when we're looking down this alley, which is, if you imagine enough of these kinds of lawsuits that overlap in the right way, we may have developed here a technique that creates a precedent for the direct public taking of old copyrights. That is, you are really doing instead of eminent domain through private lawsuit. It sets a price, it provides some compensation, and it opens things up to a pretty wide range of uses. So this is perhaps an optimistic prospect, but I think that the collective imagination of people in this movement elsewhere, perhaps spurred by the vision of Google in organizing this lawsuit, might be able to come up with some very interesting ways of making incremental progress on orphan works through setting up exactly the right class action lawsuits and settlements.
Great, thank you. So that's great. So we've now got one track, one alley, as you described it. Just let's do a version of what Google did. Let's file a lawsuit, let's structure it right, see what we can achieve. So we'll come back and work through that a little bit. And let's also be thinking about and talk about what do we think of the broader policy idea of essentially exercising eminent domain through a private lawsuit? What do we think of the question of, is that how we want to solve these kinds of problems? And even if it isn't, is that how we have to solve them if there aren't some other ways? So hold those thoughts, we'll see.
Thanks very much to the Berkman Center for inviting me and giving me a spot on this great panel, which is on a subject that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And because John made clear that this is on the record in every respect, I do have to make clear that, you know, my thoughts here come from my experience over many years on this. So please don't, they're mine, they are my own. Please don't ascribe them to Microsoft or to the Copyright Office or my, you know, law firm that I've worked for. And it is something of a personal issue for me because I have thought about this in various contexts and working for different employers. And I think what I wanted to do in the opening remarks is be a little bit of a witness to the public failure that Siva brought out in the first panel, at least a small part of the public failure, which is the failure of Congress to enact any orphan works legislation or reform. Having spent a lot of time trying to build the solution and launching it and having it not be passed, you spend a lot of time thinking, well, what could have been done differently? What should should we have done at the Copyright Office? What should Congress have done? What did we get wrong? What should Rev2 look like? How should we iterate on this, as they say at Microsoft, in a productive way? My natural instinct is to say, okay, who's upset with it, and why are they upset, and what can we do to address their concerns to the extent they're legitimate? So it's a question of, you know, how do we incorporate Larry's concern about the lawyerliness of the solution? How do we incorporate the use of registries? How do we deal with the individual rights holder, the small business owners, if you will, of illustrators and photographers, and their concern that this erodes too much of the copyright that they feel very strongly that they rely on? So how do you incorporate those things? What kind of things do you put into the solution to make the consensus and support for it broad? So that's what I've been doing over the past several years, trying to figure out ways that, you know, it could be improved in order to build that consensus. Apparently, what I should have been doing was studying class action law. That's what I should have been doing. And I look back at the process that we went through at the Copyright Office, which was to launch a notice and comment period, which received around 800 comments filed by the public in both a reply and an initial round, to hold two roundtables, 3 days of roundtables, one in Washington, one in Berkeley, California, and hear from lots of people and have really good discussions. and then go through two hearings in Congress, several iterations of congressional bills being introduced and passed over the several years. And I thought, wouldn't it have been much easier to instead have sat in a room with about three parties, completely in secret, and then launch the solution and say, you've got about 3 months, 4 months, and then it's sort of a fast track process of thumbs up or thumbs down. That as a, you know, as a policymaker and as sort of a coder and a developer in that sense, it's, that's a much more interesting and efficient process. So the reaction to the public failure, it seems to be we make the process less inclusive and more secretive and put it in a forum, which is class action fairness hearing, that is very, very different from the legislative proceeding. And, you know, my personal view is that's not the right reaction to the public failure that we saw in terms of passing legislation. And it's interesting to think about also sort of what we did wrong. A lot of the things that James just pointed out as to how you would build a class action that would be probably more, a class action settlement that would be more consistent with open access goals, a lot of those things were all discussed in the Orphan Works proceeding. A lot of those issues. I mean, it's interesting that if you look at the parties to the settlement, the Authors Guild, the American Association of Publishers, and Google were all very active and vocal and productive members of the discussion in the legislative proceeding. But they all sort of rejected some of the elements of the proposal in the settlement, which was, this is very much an escrow system. There was a lot of discussion in the deliberations about whether you do an escrow system. Do you have users pay money into a fund, and when owners come back, the money gets doled out? The individual authors really liked that because it gave them some comfort that they would actually be able to, would get paid after the fact if they surfaced. Most everybody rejected it, and the Copyright Office rejected it on the grounds that it didn't seem, if you had your filter for what's an orphan work correct, it didn't seem right to just pay money in that was never going to be paid out and have it go back, what was going to happen to that money. It seemed very inefficient to do it that way. But the system is set up here as sort of a fund, and it's interesting that the parties' public statements about solving the orphan works problem, in some respects, have said this books rights registry and the settlement, if it's approved, will solve the orphan works problems essentially through old-fashioned copyright law. Because what will happen is there'll be this huge pot of money which will attract owners out of the woodwork to identify themselves and then license the use. So it's just Copyright Act of 1976, Copyright Act, you know, that will solve the orphan works problem, at least in part, the way the parties have said that's how it's gonna help the orphan works problem. They've also, in some respects, sort of tried to minimize the orphan works problem, saying there really aren't that many out there, and it's really not that bad. So I think, you know, that there's the obvious points that people have made that, you know, this is an orphan works solution for one company and not others. I think the other thing that it does, and I'll just end on this, but I'd be happy to take questions and talk further about it. There's the question, I think, on the wiki about, you know, what does this do to the prospects of legislation? Well, you know, as I've learned from time in Washington and watching these things made, the prospects of legislation really all depend on incentives. So I actually really like Larry's analogy to the tiger, and it reminds me of a very good Chris Rock joke. He was commenting on the tiger in Las Vegas who attacked, I think, one of Siegfried and Roy, one of the acts and thing. He said, that tiger didn't go crazy. That tiger went tiger. That's what he said. And I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I don't mean to cast aspersions on any of the parties as being like tigers or being... But the point is that their incentives are what they are. And everyone's incentives are what they are. And the question about what happens to the party's incentive to push for orphan works legislation after the settlement is approved is one of the dynamic ones that Larry pointed out. It's not one of the static ones. And in Washington, you learn very quickly that talk is cheap. It's easy to say you support something, but the process of getting something passed requires effort and requires expending some political capital. And, you know, I would be, you know, I'm very concerned that while people can say that they would support legislation, the incentives won't be there. The other incentive line that I like to use is from Samuel Johnson. When a man is told he's to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. If you look at, from a perspective of Google, if you look at, you know, where they have liability exposure on copyright, and where they are, you know, and I think, you know, there are many in this room who probably agree with their effort to try to switch copyright to an opt-out system as opposed to an opt-in system. The one area where they didn't, on almost all the areas where they've been subject to liability exposure, YouTube, image search, search generally, there are already structures in place for something like an opt-out system. It's usually the DMCA Section 512 Internet Service Provider System, which does give some measure of, you know, doing something first, waiting for a notice, and then reacting to the notice accordingly. The one area where that wasn't present was for book search for them, because book search was where they were taking the affirmative steps to gather the content and make the copies themselves. They were not simply a service provider allowing users to post materials that could be copyrighted and could be infringement. So if you take that noose off the neck, what does it do about the desire and focus on pursuing legislative solutions? So I do have a concern that the incentives change dramatically if the settlement were to be approved as is.
That's great, and let's leave a very strong placeholder for just that, because I want to be sure we come back and explore a little more of this idea of incentives and where this deal, whether it goes through, whether it doesn't go through, where that leaves us in terms of having our minds concentrated, whether we're librarians or users or other companies, what's likely to happen with either legislation or whatever the next possible solution is now that the world has changed so dramatically by having this settlement out there. So let's be sure to come back to that.
Okay, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you, for teeing this up so well. Larry talked about briefly free beer, and Barack Obama is now talking about Bud Light. So I want to say we have another teachable moment in front of us, just like with the latest Cambridge, Massachusetts episode. And for me, I think the best part of this teachable moment is the discussion of the public interest and where is the public interest in all of this. And I'm going to have to sneak behind Phil here. And I know this was an Orphan Works discussion, but now there's a lot of class action discussion. I'm going to talk a little bit more about class actions, and the discussion I want to have is explaining why there's an opportunity, because this is a class action lawsuit, for intervention for the public interest. Class action lawsuits are about 40 years old. And in the beginning, class action lawsuits were seen as a boon to consumers. They were a way that consumers people who were affected in mass tort claims could have a big stick and try to get redress. Too hard to go after big companies individually. If you banded together, they would have to pay attention to you. And the law is filled with a description of why those remedies were put into place in the legislation and what has happened over the years in class action lawsuits. So you're familiar with them. Class action lawsuits that you may be familiar with are mass tort claims like asbestos claims or Agent Orange. And what has happened along the way, or cases against General Motors for this or that, or the Firestone tires that were flipping over and causing crashes. And what has happened in the evolution of class action lawsuits is that there has been a great deal of attention toward what happened in these cases, actually what happened. And what happened is, as James mentioned, and as Gould mentioned, is that there is often a collusive aspect to it. And the collusive aspect may be there in the beginning, or it may show up later. So one example, for instance, is a recent settlement of a lawsuit against Blockbuster. And in that case, the lawsuit was that over late fees, and people would return their DVDs late, and Blockbuster somehow miscalculated, manipulated the information, and people were overcharged, perhaps $2 or $3 or $6. Enterprising lawyer got together, got the case certified as a class, which is required. A judge has to certify the class as the class and the action as a class action lawsuit. And the settlement went basically as follows. The lawyers got about $20 million, and the consumers got a coupon which would allow them another free rental, and if they bought enough candy or popcorn, not yet popped, at Blockbuster, then they got another coupon for more candy and more popcorn. And the coupon was just a little less favorable than the coupon that Blockbuster was offering to everybody anyhow. So there's no doubt that this lawsuit started out as a genuine lawsuit. And of course, what Microsoft decided along the way is, if we can't work this thing out, what the hell, Google, excuse me. That shows, see, I was director of the Berkman Center around 2000. So that shows how much things have, right. And so what Google decided was, well, we're big enough, everyone knows this, we'll just go ahead and somehow this will work out. And as the case went forward, lots of things changed. For example, Google claimed that their use would be a fair use, and I'll discuss in a little bit how that has morphed. And then finally, after years of litigation, the case is now reaching a moment when it may be settled, and the proposed settlement is what we've been talking about. I know that this meeting today is set up not to talk about the settlement, and I'm going to move forward pretty soon to talk about how the settlement gives us an opportunity to move forward. The way the settlement is structured, as you may know, the orphan works, in my opinion, is a major focus of the settlement and should be a major focus of our interest. And the orphan works treatment tells you a lot about how the settlement was reached. I am part of a group that is intending to intervene into the case. There are a lot of individuals who have teed themselves up and groups to participate in the fairness hearing. That's on October 12th, I believe. And at the fairness hearing, one has an opportunity to present a view. I'll discuss the fairness hearing a little bit more in a minute as well. The advantage of intervening, however, is when one intervenes, or a group intervenes, you actually become a party to the lawsuit and you have some additional rights. So intervention is appropriate in many circumstances. For example, if there's a dispute over property and you are an adjacent property owner and you think your rights may be affected, you have the right to actually intervene. You may have the right to intervene into the lawsuit as a party and say, this can't go ahead without me. So the first question is, how did the public interest get implicated here in the first place? This is started out as a private lawsuit. And normally, in private lawsuits, the public doesn't have a stake. So if the inventor of an intermittent windshield wiper system sues General Motors for infringing on his copyright, the public doesn't say, well, what about me? I'm kind of interested in intermittent wipers as well, and maybe my car won't be able to have an intermittent wiper system on it if this thing doesn't come out the right way, or I'll pay too much for it. There are a lot of answers why this one is different, but the easiest answer, the most obvious answer, and certainly the one that a judge is most likely to pay attention to and gives us, in my opinion, our teachable moment, is that class action suits in the legislation recognize a public interest. And the reason is because it's well understood by now that class action suits never really perfectly represent all the parties involved. A class action suit can be a very large number of people. You can have a class action suit with a million class members and one or three or five representative class members. And the lawyers involved might meet with those one or three or five and never meet with anybody else, never have any correspondence with them. And so the law recognizes there's some slippage here. And one of the things you should have is an understanding of and recognition of the public interest. The other thing that class action suits require is that the class be made up of representative, that the class be representative of the problem at hand, and that the interests of the class members be more or less consonant, or at least not at war with each other. And that's another reason why you have the public interest involved. And the public interest comes, is invited in at what's called Rule 23 Fairness Hearing. The Fairness Hearing is what's coming up now. The Fairness Hearing is an opportunity for the judge to hear about the terms of the settlement and to hear how the public interest, or the public has an opportunity to attend. It's an open hearing, and members of the class have an opportunity to speak, as do others. So this judge has invited many members who have asked, or many people or organizations who have asked to make comments. His response is, come to the fairness hearing. The fairness hearing is his opportunity to understand what this does to the public interest. And my assumption is that until fairly recently, and until the efforts of a group of people, some in this room, but many others, he is now getting the idea that there is a public interest here. The Justice Department, of course, made clear that they are going to weigh in on the antitrust issues, if not in court, at least on their own. That's another place where the public interest is represented. But I'm now focusing on the public interest aside from the antitrust question. So I can demonstrate to you really easily right now that the public interest was not represented here, and the public interest wasn't taken into account. And that, in a sense, this lawsuit, which was at first a hotly contested lawsuit, became, as many class actions do, tinged with sort of self-interest and even collusive interest. And there's probably, Larry or somebody else may know, or the other librarians here, there's probably a copyright story behind the Uncle Remus stories and Joel Chandler Harris, because he took them from somewhere. But the Brer Rabbit stories come to mind, where he says, please, please don't throw me into the briar patch. So Google got itself into the briar patch, claimed that fair use allowed them to use these, and then we get to the Orphan Works problem. And what did they do with the Orphan Works problem? I had a meeting at the Authors Guild, and the general counsel of the Authors Guild explained how this is such a wonderful thing, and it's great for the members, and it's great for the public. And I said to her, how did it happen that the money from Orphan Works is going to Google, to other authors, not authors of Orphan Works, and to this books rights registry? And her answer was, well, when you're, and she's a wonderful person, well, when you are in a class action, your obligation is to get as much as you can for your class members. And our members are Authors Guild. So that's absolutely my obligation. And the structure of this also demonstrates that Orphan Works authors were basically sold down the river. The settlement, as the experts on the settlement will tell you, requires, if you want to get your $60 upfront payment, you have to register within, I believe, 6 months of when the settlement is finalized. Well, by definition, no Orphan Works owner will register within 6 months, because Orphan Works owners are out there somewhere else. The Authors Guild says, do we have any time left? 1 minute. The Authors Guild says that that they will find 80% of the Orphan Works people, and that they will show up as Jules said, because it'll be a pot of money. And so maybe that's true. So my pitch here is basically, we have an opportunity. This is a terrific teachable moment. The people who are authors, because they are class members, have a right not only to be represented at the fairness hearing, but in fact to appeal from that fairness hearing if they don't like it, as long as they don't first opt out and get out of the class. I was, for the first time, out at Google a couple of weeks ago for some Creative Commons work. And I saw the difference between a public and a private operation. When I was preparing this morning, deciding when I had to get here, I saw something about refreshments at 8 o'clock. And at the Google weekend, there were no refreshments. But when we got there, there was a huge spread. There were full-time, probably 15 full-time cooks, and the food was described as free-range. Something chicken satay rubbed with Petaluma, hand-picked lavender.
It's usually like that at our events.
Right. The people who...
Google
who,
wouldn't sponsor, so.
So the people who have recently moved from Mountain View or Palo Alto understand that difference. So we don't have each of us or any individual group that kind of resource, and Google can pull that stuff off really easily. But we do have a remarkable teachable moment here because of the way the settlement is structured, and I think it's an opportunity we should take advantage of.
Great, thank you. So lots of good stuff there, at least three nuggets I hope we have a chance to come back to. One is this idea, this argument from Google and the publishers that the registry and the opportunity to make money will actually draw out a lot of authors that would otherwise be orphans. The size of the orphan class will shrink dramatically because you're creating an easy mechanism and incentives for these people to say, oh, that's me, I can get money. So that's something that we can explore. As well as the idea of what is the public interest in the settlement approval process or any process like this where orphan works are concerned. And finally, this idea that you raised of payments. So the orphan works that Google is scanning and will make available will generate money through ads, through selling to consumers, through making them available in the institutions. They're going to generate money. You can't give it to the orphans directly because you don't know who they are, but instead it's going to go to these to pay expenses, to the registry, and then to the existing rights holders, the authors that actually do show up, get the money from the people that don't. Does that make sense? What should a system that is perhaps slightly better attuned to the broader interest try to do in a situation like that? So maybe we can come back to those. Before we do that, Lewis?
So I'm the non-lawyer on this panel. My background is creative writing and literature, and so I thought I would offer some remarks on plagiarism and kidnapping out of history. But to segue from Eric's remarks, I also been part of a group trying to think about how to imagine orphaned works. And if you really have a work whose owner cannot be found and the work generates money, what is the status of that money? And as people have said, in the settlement, that money goes to the people who work out the settlement. And we've been trying to think about where else might it go. And one way to imagine this is to go back into the history of copyright and say, so what's the point of giving this monopoly privilege? And if it's clearly not going to incentivize more work in the history of copyright, what then happens is it goes to the public domain. We have no such system in our laws, but it's well worth thinking about that. In fact, I think Eric found, is it in Nimmer, this thing about the successor beneficiary? So even in some formal discussions of copyright, it is imagined that the initial beneficiary of the monopoly privilege of copyright is the creator of the work or the publisher. But if that person's rights run out, the successor beneficiary is the public domain. So if I were to go in and tweak this settlement, and everybody wants to do that, so they're trying to keep all of us out, one thing I would do is to say, let's imagine that instead of what is in this. Let's imagine that I sort of like the escrow thing. It sort of gives you a formal limbo in which these monies sit around. But can we cook up some way to use this money for the public domain? How that might be done is not my problem. But if you pose that as a question, I think you could begin to generate some lists. And absent that, I think what the settlement does is a classic case of plagiarism. So let me explain the origins of this word. The word first appears in an epigram by Martial, a Roman poet. And it's a short poem in which he sends it a book of poems to a friend in another city. He says, here's my poems, please take them. He says, somebody else has been reciting my poems in your presence and claiming that he himself wrote them. But somebody should stand up and say that no, Marshall wrote them, and say that twice, at which point they will be freed and your plagiarist will be revealed as such. Now it turns out there is a piece of Roman law behind this, which has to do with slavery and freedom. And behind it is an image in which Marshall imagines his work to be his own as long as it is not published. It is like a slave of his mind. And when it is published, it is manumitted. It becomes free. So the distinction here really is a sort of ancient public domain in which you have put your poems out into the world. Now they are no longer yours. They are like freed slaves. And in Roman law, if a freed slave showed up and somebody said, oh no, he's not free, he's actually a slave, somebody else in the community had to witness to his freedom. Some other citizen, because the slave could not testify on his behalf, had to stand up and say, no, Julius has been freed by the emperor. He is free. At which point it was clear that this character is free. So plagiarism in this ancient sense means re-enslaving something which had been set free. So in my view, orphaned works, if their authors do not truly come forward, should be considered part of the public domain. We can figure out how to do that. And people who claim them and get the income from their labors should be thought of as plagiarists in the ancient sense and punished by law and communities. The second little piece of this, these are just pieces of... The book I'm writing has a lot of history in it, and so I've been reading these like pamphlets of Defoe's from the 18th century. And so Defoe has a pamphlet in favor of copyright. This is around 1706, 1707, and they're soon to be debating the Statute of Anne. And Defoe wants to own his work, rightly so. So he has a series of metaphors for what an author's work is like, and my favorite is it is the breath of the brain. So it is as if it is your child, which you have put out into the world. He also says we shouldn't let people take our work without permission. That would be like breaking into houses or sleeping with other men's wives. This line of metaphors died soon thereafter. But I like the breath of the brain because it's a through line to orphans. I mean, the sense is what the Statute of Anne did was to take the brat of the brain and to give it a short-term ownership. So it is as if you have a child which you are allowed to raise for a certain number of years, but like any child, there comes a moment in which it becomes mature enough to be set free. So once again, the other root word of plagiarism has to do with kidnapping. And it means either taking a slave you don't own or taking a child you don't own. So again, I would describe what the settlement tries to do with orphan works as kidnapping the brat of the brain. Come back quickly then to the ecology of culture. Down to this tree, either the thing gets approved and we have to imagine how it goes forward or not approved and what happens then. Or the middle ground would be adjusted in some way. When we talked a couple weeks ago with people from Google about this, their reply to our complaints about the way orphan works is handled is, well, go to Congress. Get the law changed. Go down this dark alley. There's someone down there who will help you. But actually, I think maybe the middle ground here is, let's imagine that the settlement actually goes through but is also altered in ways that do something much more inventive with orphaned works. Then I think you could also go to Congress and say, look, this shouldn't have been done through private litigation, but it is actually an ingenious way to solve this. Let's now talk about legislation which would handle this in a way that frees up these slaves and these children.
Great, thank you. All right, so let's jump right in. We've got a bunch of threads kind of hanging out, which are very fascinating, and I suspect any one of which, if we pull, will turn out to be quite long and involved. So I want to make sure we have a chance to pull on some of them. And let me just say, the schedule has us going until 12:15, at which time we go to lunch until 1:30. I'm going to ask a little bit of your indulgence and keep us here until a little before 12:30. It'll still give us an hour for lunch, but it'll give us more time to work through some of these threads and hopefully make a little progress. So I appreciate the indulgence to do that. So questions? Yeah, Mark.
Hi, this is Mark Rotenberg. I have a non-privacy related question for Eric. It's really a nuts and bolts question. You said you're planning to file a motion to intervene. We're interested in filing a motion to intervene. We've actually spent some time looking at Rule 24, and I was wondering if you could say a few words about what your theory is of intervention in this case.
I'll say it quickly because I don't know how interesting it is to everybody. But first, will you split our legal fees? Our legal fees so far are zero, and that's a problem with what we're doing. It's the food problem. The theory of intervention is that there are interests here that are the primary theory, unrepresented interests. There's the public interest. There's the interest of authors like Lewis Hyde, whose interest is not getting every last dollar necessarily out of his work, but wants his work used. He wants fair use and his work maximized, not minimized, as the settlement does. So it's basically that. Their interests unrepresented, and also that you have the control of the... So bring up, do a Google search on what do you call cheese that's not yours? So it's also that the settlement has taken, as Lewis said, assets that do not belong to any of the parties here and divvy them up among them. And our theory is that those belong to the successor interest in copyright. So the answer is, my kids know this. What do you call cheese that's not yours? I said to the general counsel, and she didn't know the answer. The answer is, it's nacho cheese. So I think that's an easy thing to explain to the court. Here's the one problem we have that we can use help from everybody here is the really hard part of what we're trying to write is we're saying, well, we would like, if there's money that comes from the orphan works, it doesn't belong to any of these people. It belongs to the public domain. The public domain is the successor interest in copyright. Number one, public domain is normally defined as a negative. Some people like Jamie Boyle work hard to define as a positive, but in copyright law, it's normally seen as a negative, the absence of rights. And secondly, who are we to say what orphan works owners want? That's what Google is doing.
Right. But if I could have a follow-up, and I think it's important, and I suspect that a lot of people who are following this conference will be interested in the answer to the question, because if you have an interest in the proceeding, you basically face a threshold question. You know, do you send a letter to the judge? Do you submit an amicus brief? Or do you go for this magical status called intervener, which the Internet Archive actually tried to do and didn't succeed? So it's an important question that kind of opens the door to the arguments that you'd like to make. Now, I'm not an expert on this. I've, you know, just watched an episode on television, maybe CSI, I don't remember. But 24A gives you, you know, claim as a matter of right. I mean, if you're a property holder and two adjacent property holders want to build a sky bridge over your property and they've entered into an agreement and they're both very happy with that arrangement, you might go into court and say, well, hold it, I'm going to be impacted when they build this bridge over my property. That's one way of intervening. Then there's another way of intervening, which is essentially by permission of the court. That's 24B. And it's kind of hard to get into that 24B space if you're not a government agency and there isn't some statute out there that kind of welcomes you into the proceeding. So I'm pushing you a little bit in part because it actually turns out to be a very important issue in this case for people who are trying to get involved. And, you know, if there's not an answer at this point,
that's
fine.
So I think the answer is we should talk about it offline. But the answer, the short answer is A and B.
Let me pick up something we just heard there about what to do with the money if it belongs to the public domain. And I hear this in talking to librarians also because they're quite imaginative in thinking of much better causes that the money could go to than to other copyright owners who put the settlement together. But one way of thinking about this is if the money belongs to the public domain, it's a way of saying that these are books that for ordinarily no money would be charged to make uses of them. And yet the settlement is calling for Google to collect this money and for the registry to hold some shares of it in escrow for the copyright owners if they can be found. So then the obvious thought would be to say, well, you could treat orphan works like you treat public domain works that are clearly public domain and collect no money against them. that the money really properly belongs to the people who don't have to spend it in order to get access to works that which the copyright system is not benefiting copyright creators. But then you can't just presume, Lumen reply, that every orphan work will stay an orphan forever. You have to charge money or else you've converted them all to being public domain. That I'm sure sounds great to many open access advocates. But I guess it leads to the possibility that, well, collect the money as you would for anything else, hold it in escrow, and if after 5 years they have not shown up, write a refund check to the people who paid for access to it. That is the closest thing we can get to simulating the public domain with this orphan category.
Questions? Okay, I'm going to Julie and jump in while we're waiting for...
Yeah, just to follow up, that's exactly the rationale that everyone... That was the reaction on the question of an escrow in 2005 when considering the orphan works. That as being part of a legislative solution was that it would just money would go back to the person who paid into it. I just want to make a point following on something Maura said in the first panel about the functions of this registry. The parties have pointed to the registry as a means of alleviating competition concerns because they say the registry will be able to license other parties who want to make these kinds of uses of the works. Maura's point was to, you know, let's separate the functions, and we should at least in considering the settlement keep those separate functions in mind. There is a function of just registering information about who owns what, and there is a function about licensing. And keeping them separate is a really important thing to think about for this reason, in part because, as the discussion here is, the money is going to flow in for orphans. The fewer orphans that are found, the more money goes to the registry and to the author. So that's a question of incentives about how active the registry will be at disclosing and making information public about orphans. The other thing to keep in mind is that when you look at the history of collective organizations like the registry as it's envisioned as part of the competition issues, collective organizations typically are not very good at disclosing information about what they own and what they don't own. And in fact, I can envision a situation based on my experience in dealing with collectives from Europe and around the world, and the situation where you walk up to the Books Rights Registry as a licensing agent and you say, they say to you, we've got this great license for you. And as a consumer of that license, you could say, well, I don't really want the license. Can I have the list of orphan books, the people who haven't shown up after 5 years? I think I'm willing to take the risk of just using those works and not being sued by them ever because they apparently don't really care much about their copyrights. So I don't really need your license. I just want this list that you're making here. That puts a different perspective on whether that registry is going to be really keen to turn over that list. It's essentially the competition for that registry's product, which is the safe haven, the insurance you have against being sued. So those incentives are very important, and keeping those functions separate help us understand going forward the dynamics that are at play here and whether this really will be an engine for producing information for the public to use about who owns what and what they can do with those works.
And I think that's a good sort of focus on the fact that there are at least bits, maybe very large pieces, of the public good and the public interest in this deal and in any deal like this. Part of it is you have a registry that's going to generate incredibly valuable information. Information will make it easy for people to find rights holders that have come forward and maybe negotiate other deals. Information about what actually orphans are and thinking about that kind of information, however, whatever process, whether it's a settlement or something else, whatever generates it, and how that can be preserved, insured for the public good, I think is an important part of what we are trying to do.
Yeah, and I just one quick point. Nothing in the settlement really says what's going to happen with this registry. The registry's function is to administer the monies being paid under the settlement. There isn't actually any requirement that someone showing up to collect the $60 is required to license their works to the registry for purposes of licensing other parties. That's not part of the settlement. There's sort of a cross your fingers, people will probably do it, it's likely that they will do it. That's what we're operating on right now. So a lot of it is unanswered, and the question of whether you get those benefits you just talked about is still very much open.
The microphone's out here somewhere. Yes.
So what are other countries doing to change legislation to provide greater access to orphan works?
Well, I guess I'll take that one. We looked a little bit about that. Other countries have already done some things. Canada, for example, has essentially a license you can obtain from the government. You specify what work you'd like to use, you say what you've done to try to find the owners. They sort of check that. They help you find the owner if you haven't done things you could have done. But if they validate that you've tried and that you can't do it, they issue a license on behalf of that owner. They have terms and everything, usage terms and other things, and then money is collected. It's not collected by the government. It actually goes to the private collecting societies that exist in Canada for these kinds of things. Again, maybe like this settlement, it sort of goes into a black hole and gets lost in the administrative fees of these collecting societies. But that's the way Canada's done it. But that's very much a sort of one-off basis. You know, you have to kind of be interested in using one work at a time. It's not really a scalable solution for other things. Japan has a similar provisions about orphan works. There are provisions in countries' laws about anonymous and pseudonymous works and what you do when you can't find the owner in some respects. I think the biggest things in terms of what's happening is the European Union has been studying this question pretty closely. They've had a working group looking at it, and I don't think they've yet produced anything in terms of a proposal for it. But that should be forthcoming. I think that's everyone's sort of waiting for that. There's been an investment, and it's mostly, as I understand it, been oriented around the notion of libraries and the notion of preservation of works and use in library settings, and sort of it's been tied up with the other issues of library use of copyrighted works, and not just sort of orphan works in a commercial sense.
So one quick note: there's a question from somebody on Twitter that says they find it odd that nobody's yet mentioned the Most Favored Nations Clause, which is Section 3.8a of the settlement, and they wonder why. And I think the main reason why is it's not exactly in the orphan zone. You can tie it into a lot of incentives, and I think people, James and I and others, would be happy to talk about it offline.
I mean, I could be wrong about the Most Favored Nations Clause. I still don't completely understand it, but my best understanding of it at this point is that because it refers to a licenses involving a right from a substantial fraction of non-registered rights holder, that is people who have not shown up at the registry and identified themselves, that is effectively orphan owners, the only time the Most Favored Nation Clause could kick in is if there's been something like orphan works legislation. And honestly, if that's actually happening and on the table, then who knows what else in the settlement will have been completely shifted or modified in the process of those negotiations. So at that point, if you get to that stage, the negotiations in Congress in effect will trump the settlement, and I'm not sure that the clause matters.
More questions. So let me go back to one of the ones I left a placeholder for, and then maybe we'll go to lunch because people seem to be hungry and ready for a break. But it's the idea that you just teed up, that we don't know what's going to happen, and the settlement obviously depends on both what gets negotiated and what the judge says. But what does the settlement's existence now, and then pick a branch of the tree, its approval, its non-approval, what does that do to what would otherwise have been the process moving forward for orphan works? Does it make it, if the settlement's approved, does it make it more likely? Are the incentives better for Congress to maybe approve some kind of orphan works legislation? Are the incentives greater for everyone left out in the cold who isn't Google to try to get some orphan works clarity? Or are the incentives for Congress to say, you know what, that problem's kind of been dealt with, and Google can do it quite well? Where does the settlement leave us in terms of the ability to move forward with something meaningful on orphan works? Yeah.
I'd like to argue against this idea that there is a settlement. Phil just said, where does a settlement leave us? There is not a settlement yet. There's a proposed settlement, and even the question of the certification of the class can come up again in the settlement. And when I said we have a teachable moment, I think that the judge here, who was the judge in Madoff as well, went from knowing nothing about this case and being intensely involved in Madoff, and as well having, by the way, a personal family tragedy that he emerged from, it now is focusing on this case for the first time in the last several weeks or month. And there was a New York Times editorial a few days ago about the case. And all of these editorials now, and all of the focus is only because of the Google Book search case. And when John Palfrey said, and others have said, we should have been doing something like this years ago, yes. And if we had, probably nobody would have paid attention to it, or not not easily, but now we do have this opportunity. And the judge is getting educated, and he will educate himself both in the courtroom in October, but he's educating himself now. So I would not treat this as a settlement. I would treat it as a proposed settlement, and even there are even issues about the class. The most wonderful thing that could happen, in my opinion, but it's we have a metaphysical problem, is if there could be orphan works owners who show up, and then by definition they're no longer orphan works.
And a ghost, I don't exist. So if I did, I would tell you.
I'll leave that to some of you to challenge the class representation. The judge has an up or down vote. He can't himself play with or change the settlement, but there will be negotiations, I think. And just because I know that from Harvard developmental or evolutionary biologists, I know that people love gossip. I want to share some with you. So in discussing the case with the Second Circuit of New York, Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which will handle this if there's an appeal, and discussing the scheduling of this with the guy there, a lawyer, but who manages the case. At first he was just, but then he got into it. He used to be a civil liberties guy. He's a very funny guy. And after hearing about it, I won't give you his name, but he basically said, this is outrageous. And he said, don't worry, my job is actually to have individual conversations with people who want to intervene, and so I'm allowed to say whatever I want. This is actually pretty unbelievable. Let me guess what the legal fees that Google, of course, is paying the plaintiff's legal fees. Let me guess what the legal fees are. And I said, go ahead and guess. And I think they're public, but I've learned them from a conversation at the Authors Guild. He said, it's an 8-digit number starting with a 5. So I wrote it down. And I said, no, it's an 8-digit number starting with a 4. It's $45 million. And he said, by the time this is over, I'll be right. So we have an opportunity here to educate the judge. And I would urge you in all of your public and private roles to think about ways of doing that.
Let me pick up on just one thing that Eric just said, which is in the current draft of the amicus brief that we're going to file, it's out on the public index for public comment and markup and change, so this may change in the next month. But our current recommendation includes asking the court to appoint separate counsel to represent the orphans as a subclass within the litigation.
I think, as I said before, it depends an awful what happens in the future in Congress depends an awful lot of whether the settlement is approved or not. But if you, I mean, I think what the right course would be to somehow preserve some space for a solution to the orphan works problem that goes broader than just one company, but that actually does it for a variety of users. One of the marked differences in my mind between the settlement, and Larry touched on this a little bit, between the settlement and the proposed solution that Congress at least has been considering is that on the front end, the barriers are much lower for people to get to use orphan works, to designate things as orphan and say that it's orphan and then you can use it. But on the back end of what kind of uses can be made, the legislative solution was very open-ended. It allowed people to do lots of things, including commercial use, subject only to being, you know, eventually having to take the material down if it's online and you aren't really transforming it in any way and paying a reasonable royalty for people who do show up. So I think, you know, it would be nice if we could get what would be a positive result is that we take a step back from having this approved and bind a worldwide class of copyright owners and effectively change dramatically the dynamics on this. But take the elements of the settlement, which are a more openness to a more formal system, more openness to reasonable formalities with reasonable protections for copyright owners who might slip up and not comply with the formalities, and sort of fold them into the discussion of the legislation in a way that maybe even can protect the main opponents to the legislation, which is the individual photographers and illustrators and others. Maybe we can even build a system that actually gives them some comfort too. That would be a really positive result. I'm worried that that can't even start if the settlement is approved.
Bob, we got Bob up front first, and then we'll do you and wrap up.
This is a question, I suppose it's addressed to Eric, but to everyone in a way, because we're trying to decide what we could do in a positive way post-settlement or how we could resolve the situation in a way that would benefit the public. I think it is, I'm told, that the judge's decision is up or down. But that if the decision is down, he could suggest that the terms of the settlement be renegotiated. My question is, what should we do in order to try to influence those renegotiations? Are there actual practical steps that we could take to intervene, not directly in the way that you're planning to do, but to intervene in that later stage, because that actually might prove to be crucial in what eventuates from it all.
Right. Well, first I'd note that what the Google people say, Alex and others, is this: don't play around here. This is on a balance on a razor's edge, and if you do anything, it's all going to fall apart, and then we'll be back to no use of anything. So be careful.
And the blind will be deprived of their readers.
And the blind, right? And one answer to that is, we have taken care of the public interest. So, right, you've heard that. So, I think for me, is the best opportunity, the first opportunity, anyhow, is in the lead up to this fairness hearing and at the fairness hearing. In the lead up, I mean things that are written, like you've written in the New York Review books, and what others do, because the judge will be influenced by that. And then, if he is going to try to say, well, is there room for this or that, he will rely on what he understands of the other opportunities. But I don't expect him to be brilliant about it. It's a very hard thing to ask somebody to jump in and completely understand. So I think that this is the first best opportunity. After that, I'm not so sure.
One last question.
Okay, so my question is actually similar to Bob's, but maybe more concrete, which is there any possibility of libraries being recognized as a class, being the holders of many of these orphan works, and actually having possession of them?
And that's a great idea. If you're trying to identify a group that has a very strong interest in what happens with the approval process.
And could use the cash.
Not that that would be an issue, of course. It's a little hard to think of a group that's got a stronger, bigger interest in libraries. Procedurally,
I think it's very interesting. The class action, because there's so much understood to be in recent times, so much slippage and abuse and either collusion or near collusion. That's why I mentioned the $50 million payment to the lawyers. If the deal doesn't go through, they don't get the money. So obviously they want the deal to go through, or $45 million. Because class action litigation is very fluid, because a judge has much more control than in almost probably any other kind of case other than some juvenile cases and things like that, I think that's not a crazy idea. I think it's an interesting idea, and a judge could entertain it. By the way, a judge can appoint new counsel. He can appoint different counsel. He can reject counsel. So, and he can say the class, there are not an interests are not represented. There should be other class interests represented. So I think the answer is yes, possibly.
I have one remark on this too, which is thinking about ways in which the settlement might change if it's approved but different. I also have wondered about the constitution of the board of directors of the Books Rights Registry, which is now the authors and the publishers. But clearly, this is a major cultural institution, and it should have some other people on its board of directors, and libraries would be one interest group that should be present. If it's simply the owners, then it will have one roadmap for going forward. If it has other parties who represent the reading public in one way or another, it'll be different. So that's one way I would change the settlement.
All right, it's 12:30. Let me stop things there and give a huge thanks to all of our panelists.